This is the 343 Podcast. I'm your host, John Pronich. Welcome to the show. Hey, what's up, everyone? Welcome back to another episode of the 343 Podcast. On today's episode, Gary Kleiben and I are going to discuss who can actually take credit for a player making it. And that statement alone needs to be dissected in and of itself. So making it, which we will reference throughout this episode, could mean a number of different things. And we will offer an explanation for that in the very beginning of this episode. But also the credit given to the different influences or the different aspects that help a player get to wherever they end up is very interesting. Can a coach claim credit? Can the parents? Can the player themselves? Can a league? Can a club? Can a federation? We dissect all of those different aspects throughout this episode. We're going to start off by talking about the influence of the player themselves and how they must take control of their own journey. And if they don't, well, they might end up not making it. Then we jump quickly into the topic of parents and the advantage of having proper mentorship and guidance from parents. But even if parents don't have a soccer background, they can still learn and provide advantages for their players. After that, we're going to talk about the coach, the club, the league, and the federation. And before we jump into each section, you'll hear me pop in to kind of give you a brief overview of what we are going to talk about for the next few minutes. So you will hear my voice. Well, obviously, you're going to hear my voice throughout the episode, but you will hear my voice again popping in to kind of orientate you throughout this whole conversation. We'll get started with all of this right after a quick message about our online coaching program. When it comes to coaching education, being able to discern what will and won't help you can be costly and confusing. The internet is flooded with so much information. There are tons of drills out there for you to watch and tons of things that you can try with your players and teams. But without the proper context and the proper guidance from a legit mentor, you are not going to get the edge that you are looking for or the results that you want. That's what the 343 Premium Coaching Education Program gets right. It's rooted in the real experiences of a master practitioner that has coached soccer right here in America. As a coach, Brian Kleiben has been able to overcome all of the obstacles and produce college-level, professional, and international-caliber players. Training just twice per week, kids missing practices, field congestion, pay-to-play, you name it. But using the 343 framework and staying consistent with the methodology has led to tremendous success. What the 343 coaching program offers you is a look at Brian's actual work, his real art. It's all captured and delivered to you in its purest form to help you gain an advantage and become a better coach. This exclusive online program features videos of Brian mic'd up during actual training sessions with his real players and teams as they prepare for league games and tournaments. This is the only program in the country that gives you this type of authentic, behind-the-curtain look at player, team, and coach development. It's unlike anything else in this country. It cannot be replicated, and it's not theory or speculation like you'd see in a presentation or something staged like you'd get at a convention. So if you're looking for drills, we've got those, but more importantly, we have the mentorship, the proven results, and the community of ambitious coaches that you won't find anywhere else. To experience all of this, consider joining the 343 Premium Coaching Education Program. You can find all of the details at 343coaching.com. Yeah, so I don't know if there's like a specific angle that you wanted to attack, though.
Maybe to help frame everybody as to what goes into player development and then ultimately a player making. And I say making in quotes because to some, making it is being a Champions League player. To others, it's, you know, just being a professional player. To others, it's getting a college scholarship. To others, it's just playing in college. To other, you know, there's a gradation of quote unquote making it. And we can kind of compartmentalize to a certain degree as to what are the biggest influences in a player, you know, what people or what structures. And so what I wrote down here briefly was, you know, in my opinion, these are the biggest influences: the player himself or herself, the parents, the coach, the club, the league, and then ultimately even at the most macro scale, perhaps even the federation of the country in which that player resides. So maybe we can comment on a couple of things within those categories. And then, I don't know, maybe even tie it all together with some specific examples of specific players that we may know of. So, I don't know, to kick things off, you know, the player is crucially important, the number one most important piece. You know, the player is the one that has the talent. The player is the one that is the one that's going to be executing everything on and off the field. So without the player's willingness on board, you know, the whole thing collapses. It doesn't matter what the parents, coach, club, league, or federation want to do. And that seems to be the case and persists throughout the entire player's trajectory. But I don't think development or player making it is exclusively on the player either. The player can be super talented and do everything right, but if, you know, the parent influence is a little bit off, the coach isn't very good, the club situation is abysmal, you know, and these other components are not supporting the advancement of the player will end up not making it or not getting to where they should ultimately be.
To me, it's kind of hard to talk about one without talking about the other. And I immediately started thinking about things that we've talked about in the past where, you know, if the player is a good player and the player has the drive and was willing to do the work outside of training and inside of training and you know, has the special talents, that's a great foundation. But like you said, it's not enough. And it's not that alone is not going to get them there. So, you know, when you start to talk about the parents need to have the wherewithal, the ability to decide what is best for their player. And if the parents don't have that aspect of it, they don't know what club to take the kid to. They don't know if the coach is good or bad, and they might leave them in a bad environment just because it's close to home, or they might be taking them hours and hours away thinking that they're taking them to some superstar team and it's ultimately not. So if the parents aren't really clued in, then that can cause problems. And then the thing that really connects to another episode that we talked about is the coach. And if the coach doesn't have the ability to elevate a star player or a good player to, you know, the next level, which next level could mean a number of different things like you alluded to earlier. So, you know, one example would be if your club coach doesn't have the ability to elevate you to the national team pool. Okay, well then you're just a good player that is in your club team then. So that aspect of the coach helping to elevate the player, I think is crucial. Whether that is, you know, a club coach recommending them to a college coach or to a professional team or to a national team, I think there's a number, like you alluded to, there's a number of different avenues they could go. So it's really hard to separate all those, but I think it'll be good for people to kind of hear the different, you know, where everything kind of fits.
No, and there's overlap. So maybe the idea here, John, to communicate is that's looking at ideal cases, and then that kind of creates a reference for everybody to gain some value as to where they might stand and what they might need in the other departments. So for instance, the ideal player, okay? I think we all have an idea of what an ideal young youth player is. You have that foundation, that talent foundation, that will and that drive. Okay, fast forwarding to the parents, if we want to take an example that people might be familiar with, Giovanni Reyna is 17 years old, 18 years old, I think. I don't know when his birthday is, who is having great success at a professional club in Germany, Borussia Dortmund. But if you rewind the tape and you go through all these components, you know, he had so many of them well aligned in order for him to reach those levels. So the parent, Claudio Reyna, is a former professional here in the United States, played in Europe as well, national team fixture, played in, I don't know how many World Cups, but he's definitely played for the U.S. Men's National Team in World Cups, and a great player, and is of Uruguayan origin, or Latino origin. So all of these things together, you know, gives Gio, his son, a competitive advantage, because you can imagine the parent really helping mentor and guide the player appropriately throughout his youth as to, you know, what to look for while they're watching the game together, a whole bunch of educational pieces, how to strike a ball correctly, what's good, what's bad, being able to identify what clubs or coaches might be a good fit for his son. And the list goes on and on and on, right? So that's the ideal parent component. And if you're not a former professional player like Claudio was, it doesn't mean that your son or daughter can't also make it. Not at all. It's just you have to maybe put in quite a substantial amount of work into figuring a lot of things out that Claudio already knew beforehand. I mean, listen, you're never going to reach Claudio Reyna's level of being able to guide somebody necessarily, but you can certainly do a great job to the point where you now have an advantage over other situations.
Yeah, it reminds me of what you've said to me for like the last 2 years. It's like, you know, what if David Beckham was your dad? You know, and the advantages that creates for your player. What if Zinedine Zidane was your dad? What if Pep Guardiola was your dad? Like those types of situations, because those guys have, you know, exponentially more experience with everything when it comes to on-field and off-field experiences. And so if a parent doesn't have those type of experiences, well, I don't want to say they're at a disadvantage, because that sounds bad. It's just they don't have the amount of advantages that, you know, David Beckham's kids will have, or Zlatan's kids will have, Claudio's kid will have, or even, you know, Mark Pulisic's kid. You know, Christian went the same route, where Mark, he played major league indoor soccer, but that was still, you know, quite a bit of experience here in the 80s and 90s. And so he had that soccer wherewithal, that knowledge of what's good and what's bad, and that worked in Christian's favor. So I guess, I don't know if you want to kind of talk about that, but like, how can a parent recreate that or learn that if they don't have that experience?
No, I think that's a big topic, John, probably a little bit beyond what we want to cover today, but certainly it can be done. You just have to do your research, do your homework a lot more, you know, maybe associate yourself with others who do have those sorts of experiences and learn from them. So the parent might need a mentor themselves. It would be the ideal situation. But if that's not the case, then you just have to do your homework now in this new world where there's a lot of information out there available for them to learn. Of course, they also have to be able to discern what information is great versus what information is crap, because there's a lot of crap out there. But different episode, John. I think we should just talk about the great influences in what goes into a player making it.
All right. So we've talked about the player themselves, and we've talked about the parents. This next section deals with the coach, and specifically the amount of time a coach spends with a player, and how that offers plenty of opportunities for mentorship and guidance. But we have to understand that all coaches are different. Some are great, some are average, some are bad. How do you find the right coach at the right age and at the right moment that can help your player achieve their goals? And how does this play into who can claim credit for developing a player? We're about to discuss that right now.
So we have the player, the parent influence, and now the coach is the next layer of abstraction, if you will. You know, huge influence, in my opinion. It's almost like your father or mother away from home because of the number of touch points that you have on the player in the specific sport. So if you're a coach and you're training somebody three times a week and a game on the weekend, you're seeing them four times a week, maybe 2 hours every time, you're seeing them 8 hours a week. That's nothing to sneeze at. That is a large influence. And if you're a young player, you're looking up to the coach for guidance and mentorship. It's already ingrained in you that this gentleman or this woman is supposed to be very knowledgeable in what it is that you're working on. So they have that, they're that authority figure.
Hey guys, real quick, we had an audio glitch in this next section, but I think it's so important that we had to use some of our backup audio in order to get the point across. So what you're about to hear might sound a little bit different than the rest of the track, but nonetheless, it is very, very useful information. So here we go.
And again, we can always talk about the bell curve. In any profession, there are people who are brilliant, remarkable, incredible at what they do. Then there's the broad band of the average and the mediocre. And then there's the other side of the bell curve where it's like, holy shit, what? How can you even be a coach? Because you're a disaster in so many departments. Now, where a coach falls in that bell curve is also a function of a whole bunch of things, but that's another episode, John. But depending on where this player, where his mentorship is coming from, can help accelerate and elevate the player or not, you know, or stagnate the player or even take an about course.
One of the things I used to talk about with my teams is how we as a team were more like a family because we were spending so much time together. And I was coaching high school soccer at the time. So the kids would get dropped off at school or drive to school at 8 o'clock in the morning, and they wouldn't leave practice until 7 o'clock at night. And so they weren't with their actual family members until 7 p.m. And maybe they spend like, you know, 2-3 hours with, you know, inside the home with them before they go to bed, and they wake up and they're, you know, they're back at school. And then, you know, the way that we had kind of figured it out is that they spent more time together with their teammates and then with me as their coach than they were with their actually with their actual family during season. And that's when I started to kind of realize as a young coach how much more my job was compared to like just being a coach. And that's when I started to really take it serious. And I feel like that's where some of my coaches in the past had maybe missed the mark, where they just kind of went through the motions and they just coached. There was nothing more than that. And so I wanted to offer more and take it more serious. And I think, like you mentioned about the bell curve, I'd like to believe I was on, you know, the good side of the bell curve, but I don't know. And I think the majority of the coaches that I had as a youth coach were on the opposite side, on the bad side of the bell curve. And so I've kind of used that as a barometer for myself. And I think that a lot of the people that listen to this podcast would want to get themselves to the good side of the bell curve.
Yeah, and for some of these things, they're age dependent. You know, when a player or family is looking to see what coach should be their son's or daughter's mentor, I think it kind of depends sometimes whether the player is 10 years of age versus whether they're 17 years of age. If they are 10, 11, 12 on the younger side, you know, the coach should really be very well versed in the fundamentals and really being able to build up the foundational stuff, the fundamentals in a player, in the team environment, or if it's an individual coach, personal trainer as well there. And then, you know, as you get older, when you're 16, 17, maybe you start looking for a coach, hopefully that also has those things, right? But also maybe a coach that has a network, as you alluded to before, a network and a lot of connections that can help situate the player in a good spot where they can make the next jump, whether that be college, the national team, or professional. Then I think that component starts becoming a little bit more significant in a coach's qualities.
One of the other things too, and this is something that I've learned from Brian as well, is like the psychology aspect of it and how to manage a player's how to manage a player's ups and downs. And I think that's an important aspect of something that you're looking for out of a coach or a mentor. And then especially as the player gets older. So I think at a younger age of course it's important to start ingraining those thoughts in the kids. Maybe not explicitly. You might be doing it implicitly, but later on, it needs to become more purposeful, it needs to be more driven into the player on purpose, I guess, is the right way to say it. And that's an aspect that I don't know if people consider when selecting a coach or selecting the environment that they want their kid to be in.
No, it's very important. Again, we're trying to answer the question, who can claim credit for a player making it. You know, we've gone through the player himself, the parents, the coach, and it really quite depends, because a lot of coaches have handled players that have gone on to being professionals, for instance, and they may have had said player for a year or 2 years under their belt, or even 3 years under their belt. But you could be a coach on the left side of the curve and be terrible, but the player's quality and level is so good, and the parent influence is so good, and the club and the league and all the other parameters are aligned, that that is why the player made it, and it's not because of the coach. You know what I'm saying? But the inverse could also be true. You know, you could have a coach who's all the way on the right side of the bell curve, who is absolutely remarkable. And then, you know, the parents, you know, are nowhere to be found or don't really know anything about soccer. Club situation is the greatest. You know, all the other parameters aren't fantastic. And if the player makes it, well, Jesus, the coach has a lot to do with that. And then it's the extent to which a coach, I think, has the player under their tutelage. If the coach has the player under their tutelage for 1 year, that's one discussion. If the player has, or if the coach has the player under his tutelage for 8 years, you know, that's a completely different discussion as well. Sometimes I think we wonder about this stuff, because when a player, quote unquote, makes it, everybody jumps on social media nowadays and says, oh, I developed that player, I created that player, it's all me. You know, and it's not really the coaches who are doing that, but definitely the clubs are, and definitely the leagues are, you know, and certainly the federation is. It's like those three who are usually claiming or wanting to claim most of the credit, whereas the parents, the coach, and the player are kind of a little bit more, you know, on the downside, on the down low.
Which is funny, because those three that claim the credit are typically the furthest removed from the actual development process.
Yeah, I would say they have the, geez, I don't know. We can get into that now. Let's talk about it.
Okay, so we've talked about the player, the parents, and the coach. Next up, we are going to talk about the club environment and how the club environment provides the infrastructure that is necessary for development and for advancement. And we talk about how this can influence a player's trajectory. And of course, how can a club claim credit for a player's development?
So the next layer of abstraction, as I call it, is the club. So there's the player, the parent, the coach, and now the club. The club, in my opinion, is what is responsible to provide the infrastructure and the general right environment or training or playing environment. So the better the infrastructure, and the better club culture that exists, and we can talk about that momentarily, certainly that should be an advantage to the player making it. We can take two extremes. You could be a professional club in Europe, let's say Ajax or FC Barcelona, and all the culture, heritage, history that comes along with that, and the infrastructure that comes along with that, and the network that comes along with that. And if we compare that, a youth player in that environment versus a youth player here in the United States that doesn't have a professional team even, which is generally all these youth clubs, and that isn't even a mega club, well, then those are two different scenarios, right? And that's not to say that the youth club here in the United States can't actually achieve or be a great development pathway for a player. Not at all. You can go further and say, hey, look at a lot of the organizations or non-organizations, as you will, that exist in the African continent. Where a tremendous amount of phenomenal players, world-class players came out of. And in the African continent, you certainly do not have the infrastructure of professional clubs in Europe or professional clubs here in the United States or even youth clubs here in the United States. And we have incredible players coming out of there. So we have to be a little bit careful in allocating credit to the club structure, but it definitely is an influence. It should be considered, and I think it should be considered more so once the player is older, and not necessarily when they're on the young side of the spectrum.
What are some of the specifics when we're talking about the American environment? Like, how does a club influence a player's trajectory, or what are some of the things where maybe a club can get in the way?
Right. One way I've delineated it in the past in some of my writing is a recreational club versus a competitive club. You know, and as the name suggests, a recreational club is there more for, or has a club culture more of a, oh, it's all just for fun, it's all for recreation, you know, get the kids out there to have a good time, get some exercise in, you know, it's more of that sort of feel. And a competitive club is more about, hey, no, we are seriously interested in developing professional level players. Those are the two extremes. And then in between you have, you know, a mixture of both, because within a competitive club, you could have coaches and staff and executives who are of a recreational mindset that aren't that gung-ho about really developing and don't have the expertise to develop. And so although the infrastructure might be there, the environment that the player is in isn't. And again, the inverse could be true. You could be at a club that is quote-unquote more recreational in its mindset, meaning it's not there to develop professional players, but you might have pockets of coaches and staff within there that are very serious and are very good at what they do, have the expertise, and within their micro bubble that is their team, they create the right environment. Yeah, so it gets a little bit convoluted. Just because a club is a pro club and a club is a youth club doesn't mean one is better than the other necessarily.
The example that I'm thinking of right now, when it comes to clubs, like what are the goals for the clubs, and what is the objective for the coaches of those clubs in order to, you know, advance their players? Are they trying to create college players? Are they trying to create professionals? Are they trying to not create anything at all? Is it kind of just, you know, up in the air? But the example I'm thinking of is a few years ago when LA Galaxy played Houston Texans or whatever their name was in the finals. So you have like an MLS club whose objective is to create professional players versus this other development academy team where they don't have a first team. So what is their objective? Are they trying to develop players and sell them? No, because that's not allowed in America. So like, what was their real objective? To just win games? Okay. And then see where their players go after that? Okay. So that's kind of where I'm thinking about, or what I'm thinking about now. And, you know, how important is that for the players and the families to know, you know, what their club objectives are? Like, is that important for those families to know that going in, because that can ultimately dictate what their next steps would be?
Right. No, and then we have the whole conversation of pay to play, right? If you're a pay to play club, then it's a very transactional sort of relationship, versus if it's not pay to play, which is usually the professional clubs, then clearly the interest and incentives at a club like that are quite different. But yeah, I mean, we can talk about specifics too. You know, look at players. Players come from all different backgrounds. We mentioned, you know, the African continent, but here in the United States, something closer to home, you know, Pulisic was never part of a club that had a professional team. What was his club? Do you remember his name? I don't even know. I know it was in Pennsylvania, Hershey, Pennsylvania, but it was a youth club, right?
Was it Classics? PA Classics, Pennsylvania Classics?
Oh, maybe. Okay, maybe. But definitely not an MLS club, and definitely not a club that had a professional team. And I'm sure it was a pay-to-play club as well. Josh Sargent, same thing. You know, so I think it was St. Louis Scott Gallagher, if I'm not mistaken. Does not have a professional. Now they have a professional team, but definitely not back then. He turned out to be a European caliber player. He's in Europe playing his football. Chris Richards is another one. You know, Chris Richards in Texas, never part of a MLS club ever. He went to FC Dallas and played just a handful of games there at the very tail end of his youth career. But before then, you know, definitely not. It was a pay-to-play club. And you develop, and you're obviously good enough to be purchased by Bayern Munich, and he's in Europe playing his football. And there are countless stories like this. If you even rewound the tape, you know, historically here in the United States, are generations prior, the old generations. Yeah, Brian McBride, Eric Winalda, all these guys were never part of a youth system that had a professional team. So I think we have to be very careful in allocating too much credit to the club necessarily for a player making it. Of course, if you're at a club that has the power to elevate a player to be a professional because they have a professional team, then clearly that is a big influence, right, John? Is because they also have the power to say, nope, you're not a professional for us. And that can really tank a player's career.
Is credit as big of a deal globally, in your opinion? Or is like the whole credit aspect more of a big deal here in America because there is no, you know, other mechanism of like reward? In the rest of the world, they can, the teams, the clubs get paid for their work that they do with young players or developing players, whether, you know, they're there for a year or 5 years or 10 years. But in America, there's no other way to gain anything other than, you know, kind of just like street cred, you know, for developing a player like Chris Richards. So when you mentioned actually he spent, you know, time in Houston and at Dallas, well, you know, most of his time was in Alabama. So how is anybody going to know that you know, this kid was developed or spent most of his career over there, other than, you know, we have to talk about it.
Right. No, it's a great question, man. I haven't given it much thought. You know, my gut reaction is overseas, they're not in this. The incentives are different in the marketplace. They're not in this youth pay-to-play competitive space for clients or for consumers, which are paying parents. Neither the club nor the coaches are. Yeah, here it's just a competitive. There's a competitive ferocity to be able to get youth players into your club because that means direct revenue from the parents, the pay-to-play ecosystem. And then coaches get hired here or fired based in significant part based on credentials, right? So they, licenses are a whole other topic, John, but, oh, do you have a C license, a B license, a D license? What kind of licensing do you have? Which is nonsense. And they also get hired based on then being able to market themselves and sell themselves a certain way. Oh, well, I developed this player, I developed that player, I built this, I built that. So I think the marketplace incentivizes clubs, coaches, leagues to go out there and promote themselves.
So now we've talked about the players, we've talked about parents, coaches, and clubs. The next section is going to talk about leagues. And there's a big difference in leagues here in America versus the rest of the world. So here we are going to discuss the role of the league and the influence that it has on players and their trajectory. And we are going to talk about if a league can claim credit for developing a player. Yeah, the advertising of leagues in the United States is incredibly different than the way that leagues are advertised around the rest of the world. So, you know, starting at the bottom levels too. I mean, there's incredible competition to get clubs and to get teams to play in certain leagues. There's, you know, recruiting and courting of entire mega clubs to, you know, transfer to said league. And yeah, there's also, you know, from the top down, there's massive, advertising and coercion, and I don't know how else to describe it, but just to make it look like, you know, this is the best league in the world type of idea. Where in other countries, I don't really see, you know, advertising about the strength of the league or the position of the league or anything like that. Like, it's almost like the league is just an incubator for the clubs around the world. But in America, it seems to be a little bit different.
Yeah, the way I look at leagues are certainly the least influential of all the prior components we've discussed. It basically is just a container, as far as I'm concerned, a container that helps, you know, organize competition. Okay, so league contains clubs, those clubs compete against one another. The league comes up with a schedule. The league comes up with a competitive format, a playoff format if there's playoffs, some rules regarding rosters, some rules regarding the transfer of players. And we can be talking about youth and professional leagues. Certainly that does not have as much of an influence on a player making it as the player himself, the parent, the coach, or the club. That's all I have to say, John.
Yeah. The note I just wrote down is like, how can one league do that better or differently than others? Like, how can one league in Southern California schedule or make matchups better or differently than other leagues? And so when I see all this stuff about, you know, this is the best place for your kid to be, this is where you want your kid to be playing, I struggle with trying to understand, you know, why a player should select one league over another. But that led me to another thought I had earlier, is at different points throughout the last 10 years or so, you've been outspoken about the fact that the DA was the best place for players to be if the players were serious about becoming a professional someday. So what made you believe that? And then what would maybe be the difference over the last 10 years of, you know, joining a development academy club or being involved in the development academy league versus not being in that environment?
Sure. So again, we're talking about a player, quote unquote, making it. If your aspiration is to be a professional player, then clearly you probably have a little bit of an edge if you're being seen more often than not. And at least here in the United States, you know, the Development Academy was basically the top league by fiat, okay? Just simply because the Federation declared it, this is the place to be, which in essence is implicitly saying, if you want to be part of the national team, you want to be a pro, you have to play in our league. And so all the big clubs joined that league, and all the U.S. soccer scouts and pro scouts, you know, would always be eyeballing those games, and nothing outside of the Development Academy really got much attention. So in that regard, if you, again, it depends on age, if you're an older age, let's say 14, 15, 16, 17, something like that, it's probably wise to be in that league at a certain point. The older you are, the more wise that choice probably is. The younger you are, you don't have to be there quite yet, because, you know, from age 9 to 14 or something like that, you really need to have the other things more aligned. So the parents, the coach, and the particular club that you're at need to be top notch. And you don't want to make a decision as to where your player goes based on the league itself. So certainly here in the United States, there's a little bit of an exception, I think, with respect to what the Development Academy was, and when and why you would want to be there in order for your player to make it.
What you said about the nine to 12 or 9 to 14 age range, I think is really important too, because parents a lot of times, and players maybe too, and to a certain extent coaches, are in a rush to get the players in those types of environments, when really the player could benefit from being in an environment where, you know, they are starting and playing the maximum amount of minutes, where they are the star of the team, where they are, you know, scoring loads and loads of goals. And if that becomes easy, we've talked about it before, you know, if they're in a non-DA environment or, you know, not as a competitive environment they desire to be in, there's ways to solve that by playing up age group or two or three. And so there's ways that, you know, you can still get that or achieve that in that 9 to 14 age range. And from what I've seen, it's just an observation, is that, you know, if you're rushing to kind of be the kid that gets involved in, you know, the national team pool at ages, you know, 12, 13, 14, well, you know, how many of those kids, quote unquote, make it from those groups that are part of that first cycle of national team members. So I guess my thought is, like, there's no real rush to be part of that group, and it really becomes more important, you know, 15 and and beyond.
Agreed. I think that is the division right around that 14, 15 age. But yeah, that's the extent of, without dissecting it further, John, I think that's the extent of league influence, in my opinion. We can talk about MLS because MLS is quite different than leagues around the world in that it is a single entity. So it's basically one giant club that does not contain clubs within it. You know, it's MLS is the club, and that MLS club has teams, you know, that it owns, and those teams compete in some sort of format. So the dynamics there are significantly different than overseas, and that does influence a player's trajectory. But I think I want, you know, let's stick to youth because we're talking about a player, quote unquote, making it. And I think, you know, once you transition to the professional level, we can just kind of, that's a different topic.
Just to recap, we've talked about players, parents, coaches, clubs, leagues, and now we are going to talk about the most macro level of all of the influences, which is the federation, and how the decisions at this level have ripple effects that reach all the way to the very, very bottom and smallest parts of the soccer ecosystem. The unfortunate part about the federation and their influence is that oftentimes we aren't aware of things that are happening, or we misunderstand the things that are happening at this level. But nonetheless, the federation does have an impact on player development. You also kind of gave a nice transition into federation as well, because one thing that you mentioned is that the federation basically sanctioned the Development Academy as the top league in the country. So that was the federation kind of flexing its influence over the entire youth ecosystem or the entire soccer ecosystem in the United States. So, you know, that's them. Yeah, without people even realizing it, I guess, you know, that's them influencing what can or can't happen to your player.
No, so for example, the most high profile thing perhaps is training compensation, solidarity payment, whereby if a player makes it as a professional, their entire youth trajectory is looked at as to what clubs that youth player played at, and those youth clubs end up being compensated financially by the professional club for their years participating in the player's development. Here, our federation, because we're talking about federation influence, forever, you know, has always said that's an illegal practice and we're not going to adopt that FIFA bylaw. And that impacts a player making it or not to a certain degree, because if clubs were incentivized to truly focus on player development to the professional level, then that's a better club environment for the player. But if clubs are not incentivized via, say, this FIFA mandated bylaw, this compensation bylaw, then the clubs don't look towards developing professionals as a primary objective. If an objective at all, it more so looks at the transactional relationship with parents. Pay us fees, you know, and your kid will be able to come here and train and play on this field.
That's a lot for, I'm thinking about it right now, that's a lot for families and parents and players to know. And it doesn't seem like they, in general, it doesn't seem like they know that that's even happening, like that they're even part of this. That they're even part of this discussion.
Right. No, there's so many things that are removed. It's really strange, John. I think we've talked about this before, but through our experience in the soccer world, since we're so deeply immersed and been deeply immersed our entire lives, you know, you learn all of these things along the way over 10, 20, 30 years, and you come to take that knowledge and zoom out and say, holy crap, if there's this much to know within this niche sector of the economy, which is not even sports, but soccer specifically within the realm of sports, then what chance do I have of assessing, you know, legislation that Congress is considering regarding any matter in our society? It's quite ludicrous and quite humbling to come to a realization that you don't know shit outside of your own specialty.
Yeah, it's not a good feeling to understand that either. Going back to like who can claim credit for a player making it, in air quotes again, the Federation, you know, you watch a U.S. men's national team game or women's national team game, and there's a lot of, you know, credit being claimed by American soccer, by U.S. soccer, for any player that is on the national team. And that's always been quite interesting to me to hear them, to hear what they mention and then what they don't. And they can be very selective in those moments. And I feel like that's important for people to understand. Just like I mentioned earlier about Chris Richards, when Chris Richards is talked about, you know, in the youth national team games, the U20 World Cup, whatever, you know, he's mentioned as an FC Dallas player. And that's interesting to me that they would only promote Major League Soccer, you know, his connection with Major League Soccer. So that's the who's claiming credit and who they're giving credit to, who they're allotting credit to is fascinating to me. And that happens at the Federation level.
Yeah. And it's marketing. One more piece of influence regarding the Federation. The Federation also runs the national teams, the youth national teams, the senior men's national team. So the Federation, or i.e. their staff, or i.e. their coach, so getting back to coaching also here, it's not just the organization that is the Federation. They're selecting who gets to be on youth national teams, who plays on Youth World Cups, and who gets to the senior men's national team. And those things offer a global platform to all the clubs in the world. So if a player partakes in those competitions or on those national teams, the probability of them, quote unquote, making it to a further level gets amplified. So it's important. They have a large influence at those levels. What's interesting to me, though, is this brings up a question regarding, should we really be talking about giving credit to the Federation for a particular player's success, or is it more the player is successful and this is a reason for their success? There's a subtle distinction there, reason versus credit, because certainly the Federation did not develop said player. The Federation only elevated that player to be on these teams, and that's another subtle distinction. Developing versus elevating. More to flesh out, right? Very difficult to flesh out, though.
Yeah, and it makes it even more difficult in the marketing messaging that's been coming out the last year or so, revolving around Greg Berhalter and, you know, talking about developing a style of play, developing the players, developing the team's identity, and that word develop gets used so often. And so people, yeah, they maybe just get a misguided, the word develop becomes misunderstood, because like you mentioned, you know, the Federation is not developing players, and players are certainly not being developed in 2-week camps as they're, you know, when they're already seasoned professionals. So that word development and the national team program taking credit for that is, yeah, it's not right in my opinion, but I see it. I see the credit being attributed by the people that are writing about the games and you know, podcasting about the games. You know, they're giving Berhalter or the Federation credit. They're not using it as a reason, like you just said.
No, 100%. So, anyways, to recap, I don't know how to put a nice bow tie on this, but you know, who can claim credit, you know, for a player making it? We talked about the player themselves, the parents, the coach, the club, the league, and the Federation. And as you can see, every step you're zooming out a little bit more. And I think the on the development front anyways, you know, as you zoom out, you're getting to levels of less and less influence. But also as you zoom out, we're talking more and more about the platform a player is placed in. And that transitions us not into a discussion of who developed the player, but who elevated the player, which is interesting.
Yeah. And I think, you know, if we wanted to, we could probably do a part two and just talk about that elevation or that selecting of a player and that influence that a coach has of getting that player onto the right platform or on the right trajectory, and then letting all these, you know, how then all these other things begin to influence them. And the example I'm thinking of is, you know, Alex Mendez being left off of the U17 World Cup roster, being included by a different coach for the U20 World Cup roster, and what that ultimately did for his career both times, you know, how that influenced him both times, and then all the other touch points that went along with Alex at that time too.
Yeah, there's all kinds of specific scenarios. You know, if you're left off a U17 World Cup, that impacts your career trajectory. It doesn't mean you're still not going to make it, but it definitely, you know, throws a curveball at you versus if you're on that team and you compete in a U17 World Cup, again, that can facilitate and accelerate your career. I think this, it definitely is another episode, John. I think this is another reason why, if people have noticed the national teams historically, especially, you know, under Bruce Arena, Bob and Berhalter, I'm kind of putting Klinsmann on the side, I guess is what I'm saying. There seemed to be a lot of MLS influence into, you know, who goes to the national team and who doesn't. You know, hey, get all our MLS players on there one way or another, because it's a platform. It's a platform, and there's a, gosh, how do I put this well packaged? You know, you put them on the senior men's national team, and these players' careers can blow up via transfers to Europe or elsewhere. And then the league, that is MLS, gets the claim, credit, or reason for that happening.
Yeah, definitely. So we talked about the player, we talked about the parents, we talked about coach, club, league, federation, anything else that needs to be discussed. And I don't know if we stayed on track with, you know, the player or who can claim credit for the player making it, but we certainly dissected, you know, the reasons for, you know, or the influence that all those different things have over a player making it or not.
Yeah, I guess the conclusion is no one of these bullet points can really say, hey, we claim full credit for this. It's an amalgamation of all of them. And every player's trajectory is different. Every player's situation is different. Like I said, you know, a player can have parents that are not around and not influential at all. And so, you know, parents can't really claim credit versus another situation where you have Claudio Reyna and Giovanni Reyna, that duo. And certainly I think the father and the mother had a lot of influence there. Same thing with Pulisic's father and family can claim a lot of credit, in my opinion, because they were certainly around. And Mark, Christian's dad, even moved to Germany with Christian, if I'm not mistaken, which is something that is significant. So if you have a situation like that, then maybe the coach, club, league, and federation that Christian or Giovanni were at weren't as influential and certainly can't claim as much credit as the parent. And the same goes with the other components, John. I won't dissect them all.
Our flagship program helps coaches and trainers discern what is good for their teams and for their players. But now we've created a program for parents. Because parents, you are personal trainers too. Yep, that's right. And in order to properly mentor your player, you need to know what's good and what's not. Just like coaches, you and your player are flooded with thousands of training videos on YouTube and Instagram. But most of them are a waste of time because they aren't relevant. They don't translate to the real game. And figuring out what does and what doesn't and why is just flat out difficult, especially if you don't have a background in soccer to lean on. So we've taken Brian Kleiman's more than 20 years of experience working with teams and individual players from U9 to U19 and extracted valuable lessons that can help you navigate the minefield that is American youth soccer. But this isn't just about drills. That's only a small fraction of it. And to be honest, you can get drills anywhere. What you're getting with the 343 Masterclass are the cultural lessons and an education in philosophy that other trainers and courses don't offer. It's these elements that can help you understand the landscape, read the game on and off the field, and translate everything into real development for your player. Right now, you can get on the list for the 343 Masterclass. We are currently rolling it out little by little to small groups. To reserve your spot, go to 343masterclass.com. All right, thank you for listening. Do you have a question about the topic that we covered in this episode? If so, we'd love to hear from you, and we will be answering some of your questions at the end of next week's episode. Submit your questions on Twitter or head to 343coaching.com to leave your question in the comment section. Make sure that you are subscribed to 343 FM on your favorite podcasting app. The show is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, Stitcher, and many more platforms. And if you're feeling super generous, we'd love it if you dropped us a 5-star rating or a review. And don't forget that you can find our entire library of podcast episodes, over 200 written articles, and our online courses that help accelerate the development of coaches and players using methods that have been proven to work here in the United States. Once again, all of that can be found at 343coaching.com. All right. Thank you so much for listening. We will catch you next time here on the 343 Podcast.